the Office of Intergovernmental Affairs focused on state and local officials. It coordinated closely with mayors, county commissioners, governors, and other state officials on policy, presidential meetings in Washington, and visits to localities. Individuals of enormous political savvy and intellect headed each of the four offices throughout President Bush's time in office. Each also had an energetic staff of up-and-comers to help develop and execute various strategies, duties, and initiatives. The director of each office reported directly to Rove and worked under his direction and guidance. The existence of these four powerful political offices inside the White House, most established prior to Bush's presidency, helped solidify the place of the permanent campaign in the national political landscape. The concept of politics as war was reinforced by the sharply partisan approach to both campaigning and governing that Karl Rove practiced and taught. Rove tended to look at everything from the political viewpoint, particularly the impact on core constituencies. He saw the electorate as divided more sharply along partisan lines than ever before in recent history, and he felt it was absolutely essential to keep the party base of social, economic, and foreign policy conservatives happy and solidly in support of the president. Having a solid conservative base of support and not alienating the party faithful, in Karl's view, would allow the president then to reach out to independents and swing Democratic voters to maintain a majority in the country of at least 50% plus one. As distinguished from the broad majority political strategy of consistently governing from the center and not catering too heavily to single issue or narrowly focused partisan constituencies, the 50% plus one strategy emphasizes catering to ideological purists. For example, Bush appeased social conservatives by forcefully advocating passage of a constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage as we headed to Election Day in 2004. On another occasion, he dramatically returned to Washington in the middle of the night from his home in Crawford to sign a federal law transferring the fate of Terri Schiavo to the federal courts, thereby involving the national government in a controversial issue typically handled by the states. Bush's decision in 2001 to narrowly limit the federal government's role in embryonic stem cell research and his later vetoing of legislation expanding it kept social conservatives appeased too, as did his support for legislation to ban partial birth abortion. Each move to the right garnered enormous coverage in the media and did much to shape public perceptions of the Bush administration. Regardless of the merits of these issues, Bush's emphasis on them created a perception of a president who was focusing on ideologically rigid issues tailored to a single-issue constituency, pro-lifers, rather than addressing pressing priorities that the broad majority in the center, center-right, and center-left, cared most about, such as the economy, healthcare, energy, and the environment. Rove had enormous influence in putting these issues front and center on the president's public agenda. It was a far cry from Bush's days as governor of Texas, when he consistently governed from the center and avoided overemphasizing controversial issues embraced by single-issue, socially conservative constituencies, and that tend to pit groups of people against one another. Washington is a much different political environment than Texas was when Bush led it. More is expected from the ideological purists who represent partisan base organizations and the opinion leaders who influence the same constituencies. Rove and Bush both recognized this. By keeping the social conservatives happy with initiatives like the ones mentioned here, passing substantial tax cuts, which kept the economic base happy, and taking a hardline, confrontational approach on national security, which pleased the hawks, Bush could have greater liberty to push centrist policies on immigration, public education, and Medicare prescription drug coverage. It was a strategy that worked well in the first term and helped Bush get reelected. But its shortcomings and flaws were exposed in the second term as Bush's Iraq policy began to cripple his presidency. When things started deteriorating in Iraq, Bush and Rove knew it was politically impossible for him to appear as if he was backing away from his vision for a free and democratic Iraq, even by a single iota. If he did, they knew his base would see him as weak and begin to fracture. Under this base strategy, compromising on an acceptable outcome that Democratic and Republican congressional leaders could support was essentially out of the question and never seriously contemplated. Add the excessive public catering to social conservatives, and Bush's problems and his poor standing with the public are exacerbated even more. Having a brilliant political strategist and grand manipulator of sources of public approval, like Rove, working in the White House, isn't necessarily a problem in itself. It's a problem, however, when political strategy takes over excessively and governance becomes merely a subset of campaigning, and when the strategist is someone with the skills, personality, and reach of Karl Rove, it's all too easy for that to happen. He liked to have his hands involved in, if not controlling, anything and everything that could affect Bush's approval ratings. Sometimes he worked quietly behind the scenes. Other times he asserted himself in meetings. Generally speaking, on most policy and strategic decisions, and particularly on campaigns to sell policy to the public, his views were given great weight and deference. Rove was specifically excluded from National Security Council war meetings. Obviously, the presence of the controversial Rove in those meetings would have given critics a field day. But his exclusion in itself seems to raise the question of why there was not equal concern about whether politics unduly affected policy considerations in the otherwise almost all-encompassing role in governing Rove played. Within the Bush administration, Rove's controlling personality and substantial influence over policy, strategy, political communications, and message expanded unchecked, particularly after the departure of Karen Hughes, another strong personality and a key member of the Bush troika of advisors. Karen represented a second sphere of influence created at the beginning of the administration. She, too, was a longtime trusted Bush aide from Texas. The president sought her advice and input and usually agreed with it. I recall a conversation in the early days when I was traveling with him, sans Karen. He was asking how I liked working for her. During the conversation, he said, "Karen gets it right most of the time. Not all the time, but most of the time she is right." Bush's trust in Karen and her closeness to him, her dynamic personality, her savvy strategic thinking, and her ability to grasp the views of middle America made her, like Rove, an instrumental player in all aspects of the White House, including policy. Of course, her designated role, overseeing the large White House communications apparatus, which in today's politics plays an ever more prominent role in the permanent campaign, was very important in itself. My first experience with Karen was back in the early 1990s, when she was executive director of the Texas Republican Party. She was looking for a finance director to oversee the organization's fundraising. Although I was not really interested in working for the state party, and my experience was not in fundraising, I was encouraged to explore the possibility, and my name had been suggested to her as an up-and-coming political operative. For a 23-year-old, it could be another way to establish myself on my career path. I was not offered the job, which was fine because working for the state party or any explicitly partisan organization was not where my main interest was. Soon thereafter, I headed off to Wichita Falls, Texas, to manage my first campaign, the Texas State Senate race, for a man who would later become my friend, Tom Haywood. It was not until I met with Karen in late 1998 for the position she was looking to fill in Governor Bush's communications office that I really got to know her. I thought highly of her abilities as a communicator, and I liked her take-charge style and dynamic personality. Karen mentored me in political communication. I had a good base of knowledge to begin with, having grown up with a mother who occupied the local political spotlight and then later serving as a campaign manager and spokesman in her successful statewide campaigns. The latter role caught Karen's attention. Once I was on the job, I found that she followed what Bush's spokespeople said very closely. If she felt it could be stated more strongly, more cautiously, or more reflectively of Bush's tone and style, she would let the spokesperson know. She viewed her job as making sure spokespeople adhered to her and Bush's style and tone of communication. They were one and the same. I honed my communication skills under her direction. But Karen's communication strength was in some ways her weakness. Though well-liked, she was viewed by many in the media as overzealous at times in her devotion to Bush. She was at times too disciplined, a communicator form, always on message, always emphasizing the positive, always downplaying the negative, always protective of Bush, and rarely, if ever, giving an inch. But that's exactly how Karen and Bush wanted it. Having come from the media, Karen knew the media always tended to seek the limelight and controversy, especially in the high-stakes, competitive national environment. She was not going to hand them anything to exploit. Message control required great discipline in Karen's and Bush's minds. And spokespersons who could not be pulled off message, like Karen, were highly valued.